Number 21, the cross. Matthew 10, verse 38, 16, verse 24. Mark 8, verse 34. Luke 9, verse 23, and 14, verse 27. Jesus never underestimated the difficulties involved in following him. He made it clear in plain speech, and also in figure and parable, that he called men to no easy task. Perhaps the figurative forms in which his warning was framed were most emphatic, for no language could be more expressive of the cost of discipleship than the figure of cross-bearing. A man condemned to death by crucifixion had to bear the stake upon which his body would presently hang. Shame, agony, and death were involved in bearing the cross. From the beginning of his ministry, it is evident that Jesus knew that his end would come by crucifixion. He told Nicodemus that as the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, so he must be lifted up. The end of his own life being so clearly envisaged, it is not surprising, therefore, to find Jesus using the cross as a figure for all that discipleship would mean, for denial of self, for crucifixion of self. The first time he employs the figure, Matthew 10, verse 38, is in connection with the demand that his disciples must confess him before men. Such a course would entail conflict and sometimes death, but he came not to bring peace, but a sword. When men decided to follow him, they would find even their own families in opposition. Following him would test a man's allegiance severely, for it even required that a choice be made between parents and Jesus. The severity of the demand is then expressed in the future of the cross. "He that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me." That his own way involved cross-bearing is clear from this saying, for the disciple is to follow him. But that his words literally involved for himself death by crucifixion would not be clear. That it might mean surrendering life was not hidden. "He that findeth his life shall lose it. He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." It is a startling paradox resolved by the context. A man who avoids the cross shall die. The man who accepts the cross shall live. The saying projects the thought into the future when final issues are determined, when men who have chosen the way of self will die, but those who have crucified self will have everlasting life. The disciples were not unfamiliar with crucifixion, for in their lifetime hundreds of Jews who had taken part in insurrections in Palestine had been hung on crosses on the roadsides. In a general way, they would perceive the meaning of cross-bearing, though perhaps the figure would seem harsh. There can be no doubt that Jesus used it with a full recognition of what was involved for himself. The second occasion on which Jesus used the figure was after Peter's confession that Jesus was the Christ, and his well-meant but nevertheless satanic remonstrance to his master. From the time of this confession by Peter, the gospel writers indicate that Jesus emphasizes that he would meet his death at Jerusalem. Matthew 16, verse 21. On this occasion, he uses the simple terms, "be killed and be raised again the third day." He then speaks of the duty of disciples, using the figure of the cross in a similar way to the previous occasion. For Jesus himself, it is evident that being killed meant being crucified. And he refers both to that and to his resurrection with the calmness that belongs to assured knowledge. By a picture compressed into a question, the meaning of the double paradox that losing life is finding life and that finding life is losing life is carried forward. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and forfeit his life? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his life? Lose, Authorized Version. Forfeit his life, Revised Version. A different word from verse 25. The question concerns the day of account when a man, who has so served himself that he has acquired possession of the world, stands before Jesus. He has the title deed of the world, but his life is forfeit, for he was not prepared to lose that life in following Jesus, and he must lose it now. Verse 26. Lose, Authorized Version. Forfeit his life, Revised Version. A different word from verse 25. The question concerns the day of account when a man, who has so served self that he has acquired possession of the world, stands before Jesus. He has the title deed of the world, but his life is forfeit, for he was not prepared to lose that life in following Jesus, and he must lose it now. What will he give in exchange for his life when he faces that crisis? Jesus leaves the listener to answer. Without doubt a man would then say, "Whatever I possess is no good to me if my life is taken away. I will give all I possess to have life." Such a decision then will not avail. But Jesus presses the consideration of ultimate issues upon the attention of his hearers, that they may be led to make a right decision while life can yet be gained. Jesus establishes the certainty of the picture he has drawn in such a simple way, by adding, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works." Verse 27. Luke records the use of the figure of the cross on another occasion, when Jesus added two small parables to enforce his meaning, which will be considered later, chapter 14, verses 26-27. In an announcement on the last journey to Jerusalem, Jesus spoke again of his own death. Matthew's record uses the word crucify, which, in this context, could mean nothing else than its own literal dread significance. "The Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and scourge, and to crucify him. And the third day he shall rise again." Matthew 20, verses 18 and 19. Parables of the Messiah, number 22, reads City Stormers, Children at Play. Matthew 11, verses 7 to 19, Luke 7, verses 18 to 33. John the Baptist testified that the one of whom he was the forerunner would have in his hand a fan, and would thoroughly cleanse the threshing floor. He also announced him to be the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. If the prophet searched what and what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when it testified beforehand the sufferings and glory of Christ, may we not think also that John was faced with the same perplexity? Not indeed about someone to come, but about one in living association with his own work. the works of Jesus did not altogether fit in with what might have been expected. And he sent to Jesus to ask, "Art thou he that should come, or look we for another?" That it denotes perplexity we may believe. That it showed lack of faith or instability of character, the eulogy of Jesus does not permit us to believe. Jesus immediately performed a number of mighty works, and told John's messengers to report to John what they had seen. Jesus added the message of special value to John at the time. "And blessed is he, whosoever shall not be offended in me." For the moment, John had found in Jesus an occasion of stumbling. Jesus called for patience and trust in what he was doing. As the messengers went away, Jesus addressed the crowd concerning John. He would have no misunderstanding about his faithful forerunner. They had heard John's stern words. They knew of his courageous testimony to Herod concerning his illicit union with Herodias. Was he a vacillating weakling after all? "What went ye out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken with the wind? But what went ye out for to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft clothing are in kings' houses." Matthew 11, verse 7 and 8. The reeds grew luxuriously in the Jordan Valley, sometimes reaching the height of 20 feet. Beautiful to look upon they might be, but see them when the wind blows. They respond to every breeze, bending flat and rising again as the wind passes, ever a picture of the weakling as the oak is of strength. John was not a reed. Neither was he a smooth-tongued courtier, easy-going, seeking personal pleasures and gratifying every whim of dress. Such had their place in the king's palace. Where was John? In the king's prison. The softly-spoken man-pleaser is not to be found here. John belonged to the court of another king than Herod or Caesar, but was then sharing the exile of his royal master. Bruised reeds were then to be endured by the Messiah, as he had then to suffer the smoking flax of the rulers of his day, who, instead of shining with divine reflection, were darkened in counsel and led the people astray. Matthew 12, verses 14 to 21. There is misunderstanding of the figures of the broken reed and the smoking flax by some readers. God endures both now, but a day is coming when the true qualities of men will be revealed and unsuitable material discarded. John was a prophet, more than a prophet. His was the honour of the man who immediately precedes the king. None in all the world was greater than John the Baptist, but, adds Jesus, the least in his kingdom will be greater than John was then. But John was the last as well as the greatest of the prophets. The law and the prophets were till John. Now had come the end of the law, and the one of whom the prophets had testified was in their midst. One dispensation was closing, and another dispensation was beginning. Jesus then speaks of the new order and the manner of men who enter. As given in the Authorized Version, verse 12 reads, "From the days of John the Baptist until now the kingdom of heaven suffereth violence, and the violent take it by force." A problem of translation exists in connection with the verb, treated in the Authorized Version as passive, although active in form. Dis man, student of Greek papyri and first-century Greek, draws attention to the inscription of the patron of a sanctuary, which speaks of a man forcing himself in. So here Jesus says the kingdom forces itself upon men's attention, and forceful, same word, men take hold of it. The next verse helps the meaning. All the prophets and the law prophesied until John. The Jews believed prophecy would cease with the coming of Messiah. John, says Jesus, is the last of the prophets. He is the last link in the chain. In that case, the days of the kingdom had come, in the sense that the king was in their midst, and the gospel of the kingdom was pressed upon men's attention. Difficulties would be found which must be overcome, but men imbued with the earnestness of troops who storm a city would gain an entrance. This meaning followed appropriately the words of Jesus concerning the character of John. John was earnest, heroic, strong. So must those be who would enter the kingdom. The further words of Jesus that John was, in the sense, Elias, which was for to come, evidently not to be understood literally, but only by those with ears to hear, verse 15, also show that he would have them understand that John was the forerunner of the Messiah. The parable of the marketplace children follows naturally. What, says Jesus, is this generation like? And he compared them to children at play in the market who could not agree. They said, "We have piped unto you, and you have not danced. We've mourned unto you, and you have not lamented. Let us play weddings," some of the children said, but others would not. "Well then, funerals." Still there was a disagreement. Neither one game nor the other was pleasing to the fault finders. Jesus gave the application. John had come calling sternly for repentance and an austere life. Jesus had mixed with the people, attending their marriage feasts, accepting invitations to meals at the houses of Pharisees and publicans. But neither John nor Jesus was acceptable. The men of that generation were like children who were peevish and complaining. They disliked the message of both John and Jesus, and therefore would have neither. But, concludes Jesus, wisdom is justified of her children. Wisdom, as well as the marketplace, has her children. But the children of wisdom honour the parent and justify her. Jesus was the wisdom of God, compare Luke 11, verse 49. And men who understood him and his message would not quarrel with him, nor find fault with him.